West Eagle Ed Center and West Eagle Works would like to welcome all of our participants to Buying Into Trouble, Tomorrow's Credit Market Investment Strategies. We would like to thank you for joining our presenters, John Weiss of Duane Morris LLP, Benjamin Bornstein, Managing Partner of Blue Diamond Capital LLC, Darren M. Latimer, Executive Vice President, Regional Director of Operations, Wells Fargo Foothill, Roseanne Chambroni of Duane Morris LLP, and David Kaufman of Duane Morris LLP. Please note that this is an audio-only program. Again, thank you for joining us, and I will now turn things over to our moderator, David Kaufman.
Thank you very much. This is David Kaufman. I'm a partner at Duane Morris, and first of all, I wanted to thank West, but most importantly, wanted to thank our panelists and our presenters today, Ben, Roseanne, Darren, and John. For those of you out there through the web that are listening, appreciate you taking the time to participate and hope that you will participate by asking us lots of questions through the website. We have an exciting group of panelists today, and more importantly, we have an exciting presentation. What we wanted to do was go a little bit beyond the headlines. Everyone is aware of current trouble in the borrowing market or the lending market and what has been going on. And we're trying to take the next step or two beyond that and try and figure out what some of the new players are going to be doing and what are some of the really strategies and how to make money based on the new environment. So what we're going to do is, and I'm actually now on slide number 2, and we will try and do our best to remind people what slides we're on as we move through this presentation. I'm on slide number 2 and briefly just want to tell you, give you a little bit of summary as to what we're going to talk about today. First of all, we're going to talk a little bit, spend a little bit of time on some background and discuss market trends and defaults and where defaults have been coming from, but also give you a little bit of preview as to where we believe or some of the experts believe some of those defaults are headed. Next, we want to talk a little bit about what types of borrowers are most affected by the downturn in the economy or the downturns in their specific segments of the economy. After that, we're going to discuss how the new players impact the landscape. There are many new players that have entered into the market since the last business decline, and the way that these organizations are set up or their various different strategies may affect their behavior in a significant way. Next, we're going to discuss how different buyers of debt and other players can profit in the new environment. And finally, we're going to talk about tips and tactics that we've already identified and ways in which individuals or institutions can exploit that new environment. Again, want to make sure everyone asks us lots of questions. We're going to try and have as lively a discussion as possible. And one thing I wanted to do was start off with Darren, because I know he has some thoughts on what kind of borrowers are affected, Ed, before we even talk about default rates. Darren?
That's right, David. Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity to speak today. A lot of the borrowers today who are being affected are really, you know, unfortunately for them, some of the strained balance sheet but good margin businesses that still have 20, 25, 30% gross margins potentially, that are already humming in China and manufacturing things there, and or businesses here in the U.S. that are effectively outsourcing a lot of their key components to their business, and companies that are really making sense from a margin side and potentially an EBITDA side, but just have too much debt which is going to limit their CapEx investment, their people investment, things like that. And so it's these borrowers who are on the edge of reason. From a balance sheet perspective, who are really going to be affected here? Take away distressed borrowers and unsecured borrowers and these middle market types guys. So that's what Wells Fargo will focus on is financing these companies. But for the most part, that's what we're seeing today.
Thanks, Darren. So it's really a broken balance sheet.
That's right.
One of the trends that you see out there. John, next I want to move to you. We'll take us through a couple of the slides, starting with slide number 3, on what's going on with default rates and where that's headed.
Thank you, David. It's John Weiss at Duane Morris, and thank you all for the opportunity to speak. While this is being done in a virtual reality methodology, we really are not that big of a group, so I think that we can all benefit from a lively discussion, as David indicated. It has been the case for the last 5 years or so that people like me in bankruptcy and Roseanne have virtually been out of business. The cause of that really is the concentration of capital in various investment vehicles that have fixed problems that have historically come our way. For example, maturing loans of troubled companies or companies that are having difficulty either operationally or, as Darren pointed out, from a balance sheet perspective, have historically worked out their problems either out of court or through a bankruptcy proceeding. Due to the concentration of capital in many investment vehicles and the never-ending search for yield, many troubled borrowers have been able to refinance their way out of their difficulties. So companies that would have normally in the natural life cycle of corporate America have either gone into a workout or gone into bankruptcy to fix their operational or their balance sheet troubles have not done that in the last 4 or 5 years because money has been so freely available. Now, it is certainly the case that money has been available at higher rates, or you would think that historically it would have been at higher rates, but with that much competition for business from these sources of capital, be they hedge funds or be they securitization vehicles, the price of capital has gone actually down. So riskier loans have become cheaper over the past 5 years, and many companies have been able to survive that would not normally have been able to survive in or out of bankruptcy, because they've been able to cheaply and easily refinance their debt that would have otherwise been worked out or washed through a bankruptcy proceeding. That's true not only in real estate, where the advent of commercial mortgage-backed securities, or what we refer to as CMBS-type securities, where that type of money has been available to real estate owners, but also in general corporate America, where the old 80s-style leveraged buyout has become more and more popular in the last 5 years, where a corporation that is just humming along, as Darren says, and doing fairly well, is seen as an opportunity by private investors to take money out. And purchases of companies have been made for dollars that you would not have expected, simply because the money to make those purchases has been so freely available in the debt markets. So the free availability of money has facilitated the leveraging up of corporate America, both in operational and in manufacturing and in real estate areas. So we see today companies that should have stumbled earlier having not stumbled. It doesn't mean that those companies are any better than they were when they were able to obtain this refinancing. Some companies have been able to cure their problems given the time that the new money has availed them of. But many of those companies are as bad today as they were before. It's just that they have more debt on them. Each of those investors is interested in short-term yield maximization. Until now, there has always been the greater fool theory that if a lender with capital available effectively competes for a loan that really shouldn't be made, makes that loan, and brings it to maturity after a few years, the thought has been there will always be somebody else willing to take that loan out because there are so many players out there with so much money. So at the end of slide 3, we come to the conclusion that there are a number of companies out there that have not gone through the difficulties that they would normally have gone through in the natural life cycle of corporate America, but have been artificially supported by the cash that's been available. We turn over to slide 4, and we talk about what effect that capital has had on companies as we sit here today. I mentioned that companies have survived that wouldn't naturally have survived in years gone by. What do they look like? Well, many LBOs have been done for the purpose of extracting cash, not for the purpose of turning the company around. We've seen so many instances of LBOs that are completed, and then 6 months later there's a follow-on debt offering, which is done solely for the purpose of funding a special dividend to the buyer. So the buyer can take their cash that they invested out of the company as a dividend to shareholders. Remember that that primarily these buyouts are done with low levels of equity and high levels of debt. So any special dividend that's drawn out of these companies shortly after the purchase takes place goes straight back to the equity holder, because it's an equity dividend, leaving the debt holders still on the company. The buyers, therefore, have obtained their capital back, oftentimes with a significant return, and no longer have any skin in the game, so to speak. But the lenders, who have provided the vast amount of the capital that was used in the leverage buyout, are stuck with their debt still on the company. And the company now... I'm sorry, David, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, Darren, one thing that I've always been interested in is the relationship between the private equity firms or the private equity sponsors and the lenders like you, and how that relationship maybe forces not you guys at Wells Fargo, but maybe other lenders out there to stretch for terms or sizes of loans or leverage rates. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Moving on to really what John was getting to. Now, you had a situation 6 months ago. We all know private equity was blaming the lenders for lending too much. Lenders were blaming private equity for paying too much. And that created a situation of what we talked about, pick toggle features, very light to springing covenant covenants in these deals, debt that was just too high at 6 or 7 times sometimes. For example, a deal was done at 18 times EBITDA in February in a software business, and lenders lent in through about 12 times of debt. Now, 12 times, people aren't buying companies for 12 times, but at 18 times purchase price, you figure you're safe at 12 times. That was really snowballing into light covenant deals, pick features, etc. And really what the last 6 months has brought, as John talked about, is probably now we've got an accidental loan to own from the mezz and or second lien shops, which is becoming more of an issue. Private equity sometimes, like also John pointed out, is cashing out in full, if not more. And they may sway away from the operational side of the business a little bit, and their skin in the game is now zero, and they're in the money. So at this point, the relationship between private equity and lenders is a little bit of a tap dance, because there's some lenders who are just shutting down, some who still want to lend but want to get back to historical levels, historical meaning 5 years ago, if you will, and that's really the issue today. Now, deals are still getting done, but there is a growing delta between what buyers and sellers want and therefore what lenders are willing to lend. So what was in vogue 6 months ago at 6 or 7 times debt is probably a 5 times number right now. So you can see that brings down the whole marketplace. And if you look at M&A activity from investment banks, M&A activity is slowing, and refi recap is still probably gaining some momentum. Now, dividend recap is a different story. But recap of existing debt and restructuring, whereby mezz lenders may take equity, that's happening more and more with regular funds, with distressed funds, and the relationship's a tap dance right now, and probably continue for some time. I think people are going to be interested to see how this holiday season goes for companies that produce retail goods. Also going to wait for, like I had mentioned before, for really CapEx budgets, and how businesses plan on growing. So I would categorize it as a pure tap dance and back and forth, and I think each side is waiting for the other to make a move.
Thanks, Darren. Go ahead, John.
Thank you, Darren. At the end of slide 4, we note that there have been a couple of features that have resulted from the incessant competition for investment by these private pools of capital or market pools of capital. As lenders compete for business, borrowers are able to extract more and more concessions from lenders to get the deal done. For example, we've all been reading about how the advent of covenant-lite loans and pick-toggle-type loans has meant that lenders are no longer able to determine at an early stage whether their credit is in trouble. or at least they're not able to do anything about it. In former times when a company blew through its coverage ratios, a lender would use that not as an opportunity necessarily to default the borrower and put it into bankruptcy, but rather as an opportunity to identify a problem early and address it early so that the lender could get involved in the company's future plans for adjusting their difficulties. If a lender is presented with a request for a waiver of a covenant default, the lender has the opportunity at that point to get involved in the situation and be able to figure out what the best course of action will be for the company vis-a-vis the lender's opportunity to recover. Without those covenants and with the ability of a borrower to pay debt coupons in kind rather than in cash at the borrower's option, lenders aren't going to see early stage defaults with the types of debt that's been done for the last couple of years. So a lender, it's not that defaults won't occur, it's that lenders won't know about it until the situation is dire, when the company really can't pay its payroll, for example, or when the maturity date comes up and there is no refinancing available. And that leads us into slide 5. What's going to be the effect of these types of features on loans that have been done for the last 5 years or so in today's marketplace? We've all read about and become familiar with the seizures in the credit markets over the last few months. The late summer was horrible and continues to be unsteady. We'll get in a few minutes to some graphic illustrations of that. But what does it mean? What it means is that no longer is the greater fool there. So when a loan comes up that the current lender financed with the expectation not that the loan would ever be paid at maturity, but rather it would be refinanced at maturity, the refinancing opportunities are not there to the extent they have been. So you're going to see maturity date defaults on a lot of loans, particularly in the real estate area. The credit markets have seized. There's no longer secondary market purchases available at the high levels that they were 6 months ago. So current lenders don't have the ability to fob off their current loans, whether they be troubled now or with the prospect of future trouble, to lay those off on another buyer at anywhere near par. Loans that are being that have been committed for the purpose of securitization, particularly in real estate, are not able to be warehoused, are not able to be marketed, because CMBS issuance has ground to an almost complete standstill. The LBO debt market has stagnated. We've seen all the blown deals that have happened over the last four or five, six weeks, with sponsors pulling out because they call a material adverse change or a material adverse event. Oftentimes, as we've seen, they're struggling to come up with those events. But the real reason is that the debt markets have become very, very expensive. The committed lenders can't find syndication participants, and those pending LBOs that relied on that type of debt are in trouble. And those that have been done recently will find themselves in trouble. Even those deals that are being proposed now for new financing, not ones that are left over from 6 months ago but not yet funded, are having more trouble finding lenders. Credit standards have tightened fairly dramatically, particularly from commercial banks, and risk spreads have increased. So even when you can find money, it's more expensive now than it was before. That has really two effects. It means that if the borrower does take the loan at the higher spread, it's more expensive, so the company's more likely to stumble if its operational expectations aren't met. It also means that there are some borrowers who simply won't take that debt because it is too expensive or won't qualify for it. They won't even find that type of money available, which means that the maturing loan that was done 3 or 4 years ago won't find refinancing, and they'll go into maturity date default. We note at the end of slide 5 that the Basel II regulations are on the horizon. That's a little bit longer term. Most commercial banks in the U.S. won't transition to those regulations until 2009. But many banks will start to try to comply with those regulations in 2008, and the The higher levels of reserve required by those regulations simply means that less money will be available for higher risk borrowers into 08 and certainly into 09. The next number of slides are simply graphic illustrations of some of these points. In slide number 6, for example, we see a graphic illustration of the average spreads over LIBOR of double B and single B pricing historically starting in October of 06.
And John, what is the larger spread? What is that a reflection of? Increased risk?
Yes, the larger spreads that you see here on slide number 6 are a reflection of, I wouldn't say increased risk so much as more realistic pricing of risk. The low trough that you see through the early part of 07 and into the middle of 07 is not really a reflection of what an accurate estimation of risk was in the marketplace. Rather, those spreads were driven down to that level by the competition in the marketplace for putting money out.
And John, I'm sorry, if you read actually Bank America's press release from a couple weeks ago, from their lending side, they're about $2 billion above on assets in their business credit group, about 80 basis points lower on yield. So now they're trying to make that back up, probably by being richer on yield than they had projected anyway. So whether it's a credit risk or just we need to make it back what we gave up the last couple of years, who knows?
That's certainly true. Those that have underpriced risk may take advantage of the current increase in spreads to try and make some of that back. But no matter how you get to it, it's certainly the case now that money at the riskier levels, money is much more expensive than it was even a few months ago. Slide number 7 demonstrates how that works in the real estate market. Two graphs here showing the effect of the market gyrations over the last few months on commercial mortgage-backed securities issuance. You see that it just dropped off the cliff after August, and very few deals have been done at all. I think that in the month of October there was one U.S. CMBS issuance effectively completed. And the coordinate to that is the graph on the right, where spreads over swaps have increased dramatically at exactly the same point in time. That's true if we turn to slide number 8, not only in the real estate market, but also in general corporate debt. Asset-backed securities issuances have dropped off dramatically through the summer, and card spreads have increased coordinately over the last 6 months. These are dramatic illustrations of what has happened to the availability of funds and the pricing of the funds that are available in both real estate and general asset-backed financing. In slide number 9, we examine what the effect of that will be, what the effect of this more expensive and less available money will be for companies. And as we alluded to earlier, the availability of easy money and cheap money has meant that many loans that shouldn't have been done in the first place simply found a way to get refinanced. So we didn't see the natural weeding out of difficult loans or troubled loans in the corporate life cycle. I've often compared it to forest preserves where fire is never allowed to burn. You simply build up fuel on the forest floor so that when a fire does occur, it's infinitely more difficult to contain than if fire had simply been allowed to work its way through the forest in a natural cycle. The same is true in corporate America. There is a natural life cycle to the credit markets, and they've been artificially supported over the last 5 years. Well, what's going to happen as a result? Troubled companies won't be able to find the same level of takeout financing as their loans either go into trouble or as they mature. So they're going to have to return to the old style of working their way through their problems. Even where money is available, particularly in the floating debt type market, the general ABS or general corporate type market, the money will be much more expensive. Even with the cuts in interest rates by the Fed, corporate credit markets will maintain increased levels of risk spreads. So the money will be much more expensive than it has been in the last 5 years. Bank debt will decrease in availability, partially due to Basel II regulations, but also due to a reassessment of credit standards and a reassessment of risk appetite. As Darren mentioned a minute ago, A number of commercial banks in their credit areas have cut back on their lending activity in the last few months, waiting to see what's going to happen. In the real estate lending market, a number of very prominent lenders have simply turned off their funding spigot, and the effects of that will be seen in the next few months.
That's a great point to jump off on for Darren. What do you see going on there in the market, in particular given the Fed's step down in rates again, I guess, yesterday? And also, Darren, what do you see happening going forward?
Well, in fact, I just, given Halloween and trick-or-treating in my early schedule yesterday, I didn't even hear about it until late last night and read about it this morning. And I'm still perplexed by the interest rate game, given the LIBOR spread isn't really following prime, which is an odd beginning. It just shows the market believes something different, I suppose, than Ben Bernanke feels, I guess. What I think it all means, though, and who knows if this is going to be right or wrong, I think the way we're certainly looking at it is that interest rate spreads for lenders, and especially for us, are going to be maintained at higher levels that I just talked about a couple minutes ago on the other side of the bell curve from where they were the last couple, two or three or 4 years, whatever it's been. So you've got a bunch of things going on. We talked a little bit about companies before and how they perform. Taking their debt levels, probably, which are greater than they've been in the past, probably greater than some CFOs had projected them to be, it's more and more straining the company. Interestingly, we've seen as far as a trade for interest rates lately has been warrant protection or grantings of warrants to 5-10% sometimes of companies in favor of severely reduced interest rates, which to traditional senior lenders isn't really something they're that interested in, because those are potentially far-fetched P&L gains for banks rather than current pay. So if we can take a LIBOR 350 on a deal or a LIBOR 175 with warrants, most guys are going to opt for the 350, which is hurting the borrower today from an operational standpoint. So it's a mishmash of things right now. It's going to take a couple months and 6 months to settle this out. Whether interest rates continue to go down and whether or not LIBOR eventually corrects to that, I'm not sure. I don't think anyone here at Foothill has seen an interest rate environment where LIBOR and prime have been so different, and depending on how your borrowers lock in their rates, it's going to be an interesting time to watch and see how borrowers are going to react to this and how quickly they are to sign up deals. You've got a less competitive situation now with less lenders coming to bank meetings, less lenders proposing on deals. So a bird in the hand a borrower may take, albeit potentially very expensive.
Darren, do you see lenders or borrowers locking LIBOR as opposed to prime, or is it all over the map? Or?
Well, it's all over the map. We do typically see LIBOR in favor of prime. However, prime at 750 right now, and LIBOR, I think, kind of standing steady at historically smaller delta, I think we may see some flip of that. So a lot of times we're finding CFOs are better CFO business managers than financing agents. And so I think, you know, a flock to certainty, for some reason, people may still just lock in LIBOR. But I think CFOs at bigger companies who have controllers and or treasurers operating the interest side of the business may start to lock in prime rates. I'm not sure how it's going to work out. I would imagine bigger borrowers are going to lock in some prime rates that are effectively lower than LIBOR's. So it's pretty fungible. It's kind of interesting to see. I would say, you know, lenders are saying, boy, it's our turn now versus the last couple years. So it's no warning to anybody, of course, on the phone, but it's probably happening more and more. We're watching deals that are getting done that have 100 basis points of flex in them, for example, which is something else we can talk about. But it's, you know, how a $100 million loan gets done with one agent is to provide for LIBOR, for interest rate pricing, interest rate and pricing flex. So that's also something that we have to watch out for, is where these deals go out to market and where they settle. Could be another factor.
Fair enough. John, you want to take us through the next couple of slides?
Certainly. Not only have things changed in the way deals are done from a money availability perspective, but the identity of the players has changed to a great deal when we talk about pooled capital and marketed capital. We talked earlier about how money has been available to a great degree because the original lender doesn't take all the risk. The loan is either sold on or split up, and they're being done with different structures, and the money ends up in different hands than in years gone by when you'd simply have one place where the money was, the same place where it started. So you've got relationship banking, you've got relationship discussions that go on between a borrower and a lender. Nowadays, of course, with the advent of collateralized loan obligation pools, collateralized debt obligation pools, CLOs and CDOs, with the advent of CMBS financing for real estate, you find that the debt ends up in the hands of a trust rather than in the originator. The trust is run by a trustee and serviced by a servicer. And when the borrower goes into default, a special servicer takes over the administration of the loan. That's all well and good, except for the fact that under the regulations governing those types of securities, the trustees and the special servicers for those pools of funds do not have the same levels of flexibility to do workouts that original money center banks always had, or that original even alternative lenders such as Wells Fargo, Foothill had in working out problems with borrowers. CMBS trustees, for example, cannot adjust the debt. They can't do a workout with a strip down and a stretch out because it affects the type of rating that's given to the pool, and the REMIC laws prohibit it. So where the debt lands is important these days, as much as whether there's available capital to take it out. Similarly, the advent of split lien lending, of shared lien lending between first and second lien lenders, debt that in years gone by would have been called secured debt and mezzanine debt, is now both secured. And those lenders have privately negotiated intercreditor agreements that will affect how the lenders interact with the borrower. So borrowers will face difficulty working out their troubles, not because the troubles don't deserve to be worked out, but because the lenders don't get along and can't decide how the problem should be worked out. It's important to remember in this topic that the holders of these types of debt are aggressive players in search of yield. They're not necessarily willing to work out a problem for the borrower that means that their yield will be reduced, particularly if it means that somebody else's yield will be increased. So intercreditor problems will affect the ability of borrowers to work out their debt, their difficulties either in or out of bankruptcy. Similarly, even in plain old what used to be bank debt, the syndicated bank debt, the players are no longer simply banks. Syndicated bank debt is now largely populated by non-banks. And if the syndication requires certain levels of supermajority consent for decision-making, you're going to run into the same type of intercreditor interaction that may affect the ability of the agent in a syndicated facility to work out a problem with the borrower. Turning off of slide 10, now we'll get through the next couple fairly quickly. Slide 11 really comes to describes a couple of conclusions that we are now seeing as a result of all of the factors we've been talking about. Moody's, for example, expects corporate default rate to more than double in the next year, going up to 4.5%, which is still a historically low figure, but much more in line with historical reality than we've seen in the past. Similarly, the debt, and in reflection, the debt that has been issued over the last 3 years had the highest proportion of first-time issuers with below B ratings on record. And if you look historically, Moody's tells us that the life cycle default risk for those types of issuers is generally 3 to 4 years. And so we should be seeing the life cycle default risk for those types of loans that have been made in the last few years peaking in the next couple of years, exactly when money will be unavailable to refinance it. In the real estate area, we saw yesterday a report, I think it was also from Moody's, that said that the third quarter loans issued in commercial real estate in the United States, which are is not a reflection of tightened underwriting standards, but rather a reflection of completing deals that had been committed in the first and second quarters. So this really is more a description of the first and second quarters than it is of the third. Deals funded in the third quarter were of the lowest quality since Moody's has been measuring the statistic. 93% of them are interest-only loans. And I think that's the last time you'll see that type of statistic, because as we play into the fourth quarter of this year, I think that the loan quality will go up, although the loan volume will go way down.
You actually make a good point on this, on the Moody's ratings. A lot of these ratings are required by the CLO buyers, given that liquidity pool is thinning and going almost going nil right now. The extent that deals need to be rated will be less and less with private lenders, first lien, second lien, mezz guys who don't need ratings. So that may change some of the stats that Moody's has to put out, only because that's all they'll know. So that's an interesting stat that I didn't know before you mentioned
right.
it.
And Darren, let me put you on the spot again. What does your crystal ball or the Wells Fargo crystal ball tell you as far as defaults and what's going on, and what do you hear out there in the marketplace?
Well, our crystal ball is got some clouds in it, but it also has some telling factors just given our portfolio. I think what's going to happen in this market, what we're doing is staying the course. We are open for business, lending money to good companies, as I mentioned, with good margins, who may have a liquidity and or balance sheet issue.
And so you guys are actually one of the few lenders answering the phone.
We're not only answering the phone, we're picking the phone up, and we're dialing outbound. So we think as a money center bank, it's a good opportunity. I think what we're finding is the just general lending non-bank entities are slowing down tremendously, and that hurts us from our syndication ability. So if we're doing a $100 million deal and we're going to hold 30 or 40 of it, to sell 60 was two calls 6 months ago, and now it's five calls, 10 calls, bank meetings, questions and answers, because we're looking at deals that are healthy, still healthy buyouts, but some distressed businesses that have been stressed for years, good brand names. And so, you know, from a perspective of what we're seeing, it's really all across the board. We're still seeing requests for dividend recaps. Now, they're probably not coming from investment banks. They're probably coming directly from private equity, because they're really more fishing expeditions for those guys. So there are still deals to be done. There's still business going on. It's just slowed at a rate. It's more spread, more control, and we think it's, like I said, it's more of our turn today.
And David, just to wrap up the introductory part of the program, slide 12 is what we intended to be a graphic illustration of what Moody's projects by the summer of 2008. You see how low corporate default rates have been since 2005 and trending downward. The projected 4.5% rate that we discussed a moment ago is that much higher. It's three times higher than we've seen so far. And slide 13 really is just simply a compilation of statistics that the American Bankruptcy Institute pulled from the Administrative Office of the United States Courts, and so simply is an accumulation of all of the business Chapter 11 filings that have been done by quarter since 1994. These statistics were really meant only to show that, with the exception of the fourth quarter of 2005, which was an anomaly due to the coming effective date of the Bankruptcy Reform Act of that year, with that exception, the numbers of business bankruptcy filings trended down from 2001, when they were at a more normal level, down into these very low levels that we see in 2006 by quarter. We're at 4,000 almost in the first quarter of 2006, which is just really unnatural. And you can see that starting in 2007, even before the credit seizures of the summer, those numbers were trending back upwards again. And when those figures come out for the third and fourth quarter of 2007, you'll see that those are dramatically higher and back to a more normal range of the that you see at the table. So that's our summary of what has happened in the last few months, and what effect it will have, and what types of things we're going to be seeing in the future. David, I think you want to go. You want to take it up next?
Yeah. Thanks, John. Roseanne, why don't you pick up there and start talking briefly about a couple of the next slides. In particular, tell us who you see, what kind of borrowers are most effective. We've touched on that a little bit, but maybe you can spend a few minutes on that too.
Sure, I'm happy to, David. This is Roseanne Chambrone. I'm also from Duane Morris, and I'm happy to be participating this afternoon. On slide 14, we're going to talk a little bit about what types of borrowers are most affected by the current downturn. You can see on that slide that we've listed for you general factors that are going to affect particular borrowers and industries. If you look at the following slide on slide 15, we have for you a chart for Moody's Investor Services, which has targeted the default rates of particular industries. You can see that the construction and building industry is certainly high. We believe that the real estate industry is going to be the driving force in the next few months behind many of the defaults that we're going to see. Anything that is impacted by or related to the construction industry will be affected. Home furnishings, wood, the timber industry is in a lot of trouble right now. Anything relating to furniture or upholstery will be affected directly relating to that downturn in the construction industry. In addition, as home prices decline and the availability of people to tap into the equity in their home declines, you're also going to see an increase in defaults in the consumer electronics and retail industries, and it will be interesting to see how that plays out over the very hot retail Christmas season that is coming up for us. But a lot of people think that consumer electronics and retail will be affected, which is really just another outgrowth of the construction industry and the tightening up that we're seeing there. Standard & Poor's predicted that forestry companies, home builders, and media and entertainment will be at risk in 2008, which goes hand in hand with Moody's and what we've seen to be the environment here. That brings us really through slide 16 and who the players are in this new environment that we're seeing. And this goes back to a lot of what John Weiss had spoken about earlier, noting the increase in hedge funds, private equity firms, and non-traditional lenders entering the market. The entities that are lending today are much different than the lenders of 20 years ago. If you look at 1985, in 1985, commercial banks held 71% of leveraged loans, various investment funds held 16%, insurance companies and other financial institutions held 13%. 20 years later, in 2005, hedge funds and other specialty vehicles such as CLOs were in the market for 66% of it. Commercial banks went from 71% in 1985 down to 23% in 2005, and other financial institutions held only 11% of all leveraged loans made in 2005. That is significant because each of these different lenders have different recovery objectives. Traditionally, bank lenders look to their profits based on interest and fees. That's where they made their money. As John Weiss spoke about earlier, they were very often relationship lenders. They were in for the long haul. Today, with the advent of hedge funds, private equity firms, and other specialty vehicles, you no longer have lending institutions that are in for the long haul and in just for their interest in fees. Instead, you have lending institutions that are there for short-term yield. They are interested in maximizing and getting their recovery much quicker and at much higher rates. So the entire lending environment is different today, and that's going to impact what happens during the downturn.
Let's take a pause there for a second. Ben, you've been around for a while. You've seen ups and downs in the cycle, and one could argue you're one of the new entrants into this market. Talk a little bit about that new environment, some of the new entrants, and how their incentives, how they're structured, how their incentives force them to do things a little bit differently, as Roseanne was saying.
Sure. Thanks, David. This is Ben Bornstein of Blue Diamond Capital, and happy to be participating in this great panel discussion today. As David points out, I'm not the oldest guy in the room, but I'm not the youngest guy in the room. And the different participants in the debt marketplaces these days really vary anywhere from guys who are looking to essentially pursue an equity-like strategy, a loan-to-own strategy. Other firms who are looking to make a decent yield, like ours, where we're really looking to work on, I'll call it a medium-term basis with our borrowers. And then other players who, whether they're debtor-in-possession lenders or exit financing guys, who are really looking for the, I'll call it the classic spread income that we were just discussing. So you really have to look at what's the investment objective of the alternative player who's getting involved in a transaction. So what we focused on at Blue Diamond is really to work with our borrowers who are in a period of struggle or distress and bring them back to the capital markets. It's a little bit of a different play than what a lot of others are doing. And the last feature I wanted to add is you also have what I'll call it the traditional hedge fund who will look as a trading strategy. And my old employer, GE Capital, also was a player in that market in as much as they would like to trade in and out of syndicated bank debt. So you really have a very wide and diverse universe of players these days.
Thanks, Ben. Roseanne, you want to pick up on that?
As far as having the diverse lenders in the marketplace, well, I think I think Ben said it very succinctly, is that different lenders have different recovery objectives, and it entirely depends on the lender that has made the loan as to where they're going to go once the company goes in default. It's going to impact their strategy on the default, and it's going to impact the actions that they take either inside or outside of bankruptcy. And I think with that, we can probably move on I think we're up to slide 18 now, aren't we, David?
Well, just briefly, I just wanted to touch on slide 17. And,
sure.
And the two of you talked a little bit about that, but there are a couple different areas and a couple different ways in which these new players are going at this. There was a time a long time ago where most borrowers, they had a relationship with a large commercial bank or a commercial bank of some size. If they had problems, they worked with the commercial bank, and then there was a whole restructuring workout group or special situations or whatever they were called. Now many of those banks have sold off their loans, syndicated those out, sold them off into pools, etc. So there's that increase in liquidity has also increased the ability of others to pick up these loans, and they're doing a bunch of different things. They're buying loans in default. They're buying loans that are close to maturity. They're buying loans that the price has been beaten down. They're buying claims in bankruptcy. They're doing dip financing. They're doing 363 sales of assets or entire companies out of bankruptcy. So there's a whole different set of actors, and as we talked about briefly, they've looked at this from different perspectives, and they're going at it from different life cycles in the company or life cycles in a loan per se. One of the things we did want to mention for those people who are looking at this is what is one way to sort of profit from this? And on slide 18, I'll just spend a few minutes about talking about this. And clearly, it's all the classic companies, the companies I think Ben has mentioned and also Darren have mentioned, companies that really they'd rather go at them with a balance sheet fix than companies that are broken. My bankruptcy partners always tell me that bankruptcy can be a legal solution, but you still got to fix the business problem. So often the right companies to invest in are those with fundamentally good operations but have a balance sheet issue. Or maybe there's some other challenges. They don't have the right management, or they're in a consolidating industry and they're either trying to be one of the consolidators or one of the consolidatees. John, can you speak to a few minutes on slide 19 about some of the new ways these investors have gotten information out there?
Certainly. Well, certainly in the real estate area, investors that are looking for ways to get into troubled situations and make a buck are able to access regular reports from CMBS servicers. There are any number of different ways of getting those reports, even if you're not a bondholder in the trust. So You can get information like that from those types of reports coming from the administrator of the asset. Similarly, you can find in any pooled capital situation, a CDO or a CLO, any place where loans are purchased and held, the administrators of those types of pools are obligated to communicate regularly with their holders, or at least to respond. So a holder of a CLO bond or a CDO type security can easily contact the trustee and get fairly detailed information on a particular asset that's in the pool. And that would allow that purchaser, that prospective purchaser, to find out about a particular loan that's in the pool and make an offer to buy it out of that pool. And I think that in the future you'll see more people accessing that type of information in order to make individual loan type investments in addition to holding those types of pooled loan securities. I know that Roseanne has been studying carefully the rules that are applicable once a company gets into bankruptcy, and that's noted in the second bullet point on slide 19. And Roseanne, maybe you can comment on that more effectively than I.
Sure. One of the new changes to the bankruptcy code that was implemented in 2005 was a change to Section 1102 of the code, and briefly stated, that change now requires unsecured creditors committees that are appointed in any Chapter 11 case to provide access to information to other unsecured creditors who are a member of that general claim pool but are not members of the committee. What that has done is that has created a source of information for claims traders and for other people that are interested in purchasing unsecured debt of a bankrupt corporation. It would allow them access to information that they wouldn't otherwise have. Most large bankruptcies now have particular orders that are in place that govern the dissemination of this information. A lot of times you'll have a website that has been set up that has information available to other unsecured creditors. And in addition, there are oftentimes email addresses and toll-free numbers that are set up that allow these creditors the ability to call committee counsel or email committee counsel to lob in particular questions that they might have. There are certainly protections that are in place with respect to this new code section, and there are going to be limitations on certain information that is available. Any information that is non-public or proprietary might be restricted. And in addition to that, there are obviously concerns about the securities laws and anything that might be a violation of the securities laws. Information that would fall into that category has also been restricted. But generally speaking now, because of the new bankruptcy code, you do have an additional source for information that you didn't have before.
Thanks, Roseanne. I guess want to go to what I thought was the most interesting piece of the program, which is the last handful of slides, which are really some tips and tactics and some strategies on how best to go after these. And John, why don't you lead us off on that?
Certainly. The bank, as David said, what we really wanted to get to for the meat of the program is to talk about how players that expect to move their pools of capital into the distressed area make mistakes, and how they can possibly do it better than some have been doing in the recent past. With the low volume of bankruptcy cases over the last 4 or 5 years, there's been a lot of institutional knowledge lost in the investment community as to how bankruptcy works. And we've seen in the recent past a number of very well-capitalized players try and accomplish things in a bankruptcy case that are difficult to accomplish, or if you go about them the wrong way, will simply not be accomplished.
Let me interrupt you for a second and try and get a comment from Ben. I know bankruptcy is the last place you want to be. Why is that for the kinds of deals that you're looking at?
David, I think the reason that we attempt to avoid bankruptcy when and where we can is that we find the bankruptcy process to be one which inevitably creates delays and uncertainty and additional cost without, I'll say, a commensurate benefit to the business. I think from an investor's perspective, bankruptcy makes a lot of sense where you need to use the various tools such as rejecting contracts, executory contracts, or somehow eliminating or scaling down obligations and liabilities. But where we're talking in general about just a simple balance sheet restructure or recutting of the balance sheet, we find that the bankruptcy process itself doesn't necessarily bring a whole lot of benefit to the table.
And Darren, do you have some thoughts on bankruptcy versus non-bankruptcy process?
I would agree with Ben. We you know, used to in the old days we'd get opportunities to try and put priming dips in place and get involved in a business, and those don't happen anymore. And now the extent that we get a lot of calls from other senior lenders to buy paper at slight discounts of pre-bankruptcy born businesses, if you will, not something we're that interested in getting involved. It's just it's too much uncertainty, and it's too much work for how much you can get paid for doing that type of work and how long it takes. So these are often, you know, years plus cases sometimes, and you end up with an unknown equity partner who's some kind of trade creditor potentially out of the country, which is always an issue, and you end up with kind of discombobulated, weaker management who's coming in and maybe only be temporary in place, and you come in with a business that probably just shouldn't be around if you've got 7 or 9 or 11% margins, and it's just not working. So we're not trying to be involved in the loan to liquidation strategy. It's not something that we want to do. Now, do we do them? Sure, on selected bases where we think a company can work, but sometimes it makes sense that business just isn't necessary. So there's a lot of tired brand names out there that have been in distress for 5, 7, 12, 15 years that are still making it, but competition and technology are just killing these companies, and to the extent you're financing them, buyer beware. So trying to stay away from those, and that's really our goal.
Thanks.
John, why don't you pick up from there?
Thank you, David. Really, slides 20 and 21 are intended to be similar, but to describe the same type of problems as they occur in slide 20 out of bankruptcy and in slide 21 in bankruptcy, and is really meant as a reminder to those who have kind of forgotten how this works. Outside of bankruptcy, creditors and a borrower will explore a workout, but the sophisticated creditor will always have an eye on a bankruptcy case because the workout is an alternative to a bankruptcy. So no creditor is willing to do worse in a workout than they could do in a bankruptcy. And that particular slice of the capital structure that is being proposed to get less out of court than they would in court is the same slice of the capital structure who will be rejecting those types of workout proposals and forcing the company into bankruptcy. So it's important to understand going into an out-of-court workout that every one of your negotiating partners will have an eye on a bankruptcy case and the expected recovery that they'll get in bankruptcy. And to the extent that proposals are made that will give creditors less than they would get in a bankruptcy case, those types of creditors can be expected to reject those proposals. It's important to understand, in other words, that out of court, you need to get everyone's cooperation, and reasonable workout proposals will succeed. Unreasonable workout proposals, or those that provide a particular slice of the capital structure with less than they could get in bankruptcy, those types of proposals will fail. That is especially true given the fact that despite market conditions, there are aggressive players in the secondary market purchasing claims for less than face value, that those types of players will buy into a situation at low prices, depending on how the market perceives the credit. And in order to make money, those folks don't need to get back to par in their recovery. They simply need to double the level of recovery that was proposed before. We've seen many situations in years gone by where holders of debt will buy at 5 cents on the dollar, kick up as much dust as they can in an out-of-court workout to get their recovery to 10 cents, and if it's done quickly, they've achieved a very effective return on equity. Similarly, in slide 21, inside the bankruptcy system, and this is particularly important, bankruptcy processes are run in a fairly expected way. There's a way things are done in bankruptcy court. The bankruptcy bar in particular is a very small community, and the lawyers know how to run a case, or at least they know how the cases have been run up until now. And cases will naturally run in that fashion. Judges are used to it. The lawyers are used to it. Investors, particularly those who think that they can come into a game late, disrupt the game and cause the deal to either blow up or threaten to blow it up in order to get some higher return than they're being promised up until that point in the bankruptcy case, are going to be disappointed in any number of different ways. Bankruptcy courts, as we say on our slide, are courts of equity. Judges have virtually unfettered discretion to do whatever they want. And if a case has been run smoothly with active negotiations between creditor groups to get the case along to a closing point, and one creditor group comes in at the very end to try to disrupt the process simply to achieve an investment objective, a short-term investment objective, the judges who have control over what happens in their court will do everything they can to make sure that doesn't happen. The judges are not necessarily familiar with the way these instruments work, so if a particular investor tries to manipulate the terms of the investment security, and we're thinking particularly here about first lien and second lien lending, if a particular lender tries to manipulate what they think are legitimate features of their security to disrupt a smooth operation of the bankruptcy process, a judge is not going to be familiar with those instruments and cannot be expected to simply automatically give credence to those features of the instruments.
I mean, these judges, their jobs are to move cases in the system and out of the system, correct?
That's right. It's not the problem that I think we've seen in the recent past and that we're going to see in the future is that the objectives of the players on the creditor side are not the same as the objectives of the judge or the objectives of the debtor. Particularly in a reorganization case, both the judge and the debtor, and probably the creditor's committee, so you've got almost all three of the important players on one side of the equation, all three of them have the same objective, which is to reorganize the company. Short-term investors, particularly those who buy into a bankruptcy case late in the process, don't care about that. All they care about is whether they can sell their securities for more than they bought them. The judge, debtor's counsel, and committee counsel will see those types of people as threats and will not generally allow them to disrupt the process simply to achieve their own personal investment objective, no matter what your securities say and no matter how firm your legal footing may be. It's a court of equity, and the judge can do whatever the judge wants to do.
John and Roseanne, I have a couple of questions for you in terms of just some of the changes, both in the way the code was revised with regard to exclusivity, as well as what has occurred in some of the larger cases with different, I'll call it claims transfer orders. Can you guys comment on each one? And I guess with regard to exclusivity in particular, how do you see the changes in the statute? Do we have any early reads yet in terms of how the reorgs are going to be handled down the road? And then secondly, and this is sort of important from an investor standpoint, as far as the claims trading orders are concerned, how much have you seen that actually affect the ability of investors to get in and out of different debt instruments?
This is Roseanne Chambroni. I can address first the exclusivity portion of your question. What Ben is talking about is Section 1121D2 of the code, and that provides for a particular time period in which a debtor in possession has the exclusive right to file a plan of reorganization and to solicit acceptances of it. It kind of protects them from other aggressive creditors in the case and allows them to put forth their idea of what the restructuring or plan should look like. It used to be back in the day that the code provided for an initial period of 120 days to file a plan, 180 days to solicit acceptances, and there were liberal extensions of that. It was routinely extended for years, in fact, United Airlines being one of them. What the new bankruptcy code did is it restricts that period to a maximum of 20 months, 18 months to file your plan and 20 months to solicit acceptances. So it no longer allows a debtor to nestle in Chapter 11. It no longer allows a debtor that is facing complex problems like United Airlines the flexibility to enter into bankruptcy for a long kind of unended term. It puts a cap on it. So what that has done is that it has limited the usefulness of bankruptcy to certain companies. You now need to know when you go in, when you're going to come out, and you have a maximum of 20 months to get there. It doesn't mean to say that after that 20 months, you know, you're kicked out of the process. It just means that it opens that process up to other creditors, and the debtor is at a disadvantage. I think as a result of that, you're going to have certain debtors that can't file or that can't maximize their restructuring potential within that time period. I think as a result, you're going to see a lot more debtors enter into Chapter 11 to do 363 sales, and you're going to see a lot of debtors that do prepackaged plans. They tie everything up. They reach all their deals with all their creditor constituencies before they go in. So you're going to see a material change in the bankruptcy landscape because of that. Did that answer your question, Ben?
Yeah, no, that was great. Thank you.
And it's John Weiss. It's difficult. It's a little bit difficult to see the end game of that, Ben. Your question going to what has the effect been so far? The changes Roseanne described really went into effect in October of 2005, which is more than 18 months ago. But there have not really been that many large Chapter 11 cases that have filed after the effective date of the amendments that have yet bumped up against the 18-month limitation. In other words, we haven't seen a large corporate debtor, struggle up against that deadline and ask a judge to do something about it. The deadline was intended, as Roseanne said, to be firm, that there be no extensions of it, and to take away from the debtor that leverage to stay in bankruptcy forever without anybody being able to do anything about it. We haven't yet seen how that change will be implemented, at least in a very compelling situation. I mean, if, for example, United Airlines that Roseanne mentioned was in bankruptcy for 3 years. If they had been forced to file a plan at the 18-month mark of their bankruptcy case, they would have had a very difficult time doing so. There were significant issues in that case that had not yet been litigated to conclusion. It would have been very difficult to come up with an exit plan at the 18-month mark. If United had been subject to the current law and came up against its 18-month deadline. United, as I'm sure a lot of you know, had a very, very friendly judge here in Chicago who was rooting for the debtor. And if they had made a motion to the debtor to extend that 18-month period, I can't tell you for sure what Judge Weedoff would have done with that, despite the certainty that the law was intended to provide. So that part of it's still a little bit out there. The law is certainly clear, but it hasn't yet been implemented by a judge. And as I said a few minutes ago, the judge has control over everything that happens.
And you know, Ben,
so we haven't yet seen a judge who's seen the exclusivity period run by and then say, well, look, I'm really not prepared to approve anybody's disclosure statement at this time.
It hasn't happened.
Go ahead, John.
It has happened that since the effective date of the amendments that corporate debtors have bumped up against the 18-month deadline. I've not yet seen any of them litigate aggressively for an extension of that deadline. They've been relatively small borrowers in bankruptcy, and certainly none that would present as compelling an argument for an extension as my example of United Airlines.
Part of the reason it also hasn't been addressed is a lot of the larger companies that were faced with the possibility of filed before October of 2005. You had a lot of the airlines went in, Delta, Northwest Airlines, all went in before October of 2005 with the idea that they were going to need to go in and they might as well go in before the rules changed because that would afford them the maximum opportunity to benefit from a filing. So, you know, you're still bumping up against the rash of filings that occurred prior to the effective date of the amendments.
So we'll have to see how that sorts out.
Right. And David, just to finish off on 21, with the relative lack of institutional memory concerning the last bankruptcy cycle, there have been a number of institutions that may have lost people that understand how things work and how things don't work. In bankruptcy, for example, a client of mine recently called and said that they had purchased a piece of debt that was secured, and that the borrower was threatening bankruptcy. The client indicated that they weren't concerned about bankruptcy because they were a secured creditor, and that meant that they could simply take their collateral whenever they wanted. That's just not true. The bankruptcy process prevents creditors from taking their collateral whenever they want. That's the entire purpose of the automatic stay. So it puts creditors into a weaker position than they might anticipate. I don't mean to imply that they're in a subordinate position to the debtor. Creditors certainly have, particularly secured creditors, have a very strong legal position to advocate. But the bankruptcy process is a negotiation process. Congress designed the code to encourage and, in fact, require negotiations between even creditors that have strong legal positions. And, in fact, one could argue that the stronger your legal position, the more the judge is going to force you to negotiate, because judges don't like to see corporate Chapter 11 cases come in and simply go out to the benefit of the single secured creditor. So it's important to remember that when you're considering investing in troubled securities, particularly those that are headed toward bankruptcy, that while the terms of your security may say one thing, if the situation ends up in bankruptcy, you may be forced to negotiate something else. And that process can take some time, as we indicate at the end of slide number 21. In slide number 22,
go ahead, John.
Sorry, let me just wrap that topic up a little bit. It's important to understand that no one controls the process. Buying a security, a type of security, or buying a number of bonds, for example, that may get you a controlling voice in the bondholder class, doesn't necessarily mean you control the bankruptcy process, and there's almost nothing you can do about that, particularly the later you get in the game. And Roseanne will speak about this in a minute, that a part of the tactics that should be considered when contemplating investing in distressed securities is where the game is when you're going to buy. The later you buy in the game, particularly if the company's in bankruptcy, the less likely you are to achieve the types of objectives that are listed here. You cannot, for example, expect to effectively buy control over a particular class of debt or equity late in a bankruptcy when a plan is about to be proposed or confirmed, and expect that simply because you bought the securities, you can now blow up the deal, as they say, and get yourself a better return than what you may have paid for those securities in the open market. And I know, Roseanne, you have a couple of examples that you wanted to talk about there.
Sure. A classic example of that is what happened in the Northwest Airlines case in the Southern District of New York, where an ad hoc committee of equity security holders came in fairly late in the game and attempted to disrupt the process. What happened in that case is very interesting because it really got to the heart of what the hedge funds and equity holders valued in that case. What happened was the debtor essentially moved the court to require that ad hoc committee of equity security holders under Bankruptcy Rule 2019 to disclose their holdings, when they purchased them, and what they paid for them. The end result of that, it's a very, very interesting case in how everything transpired there, but the end result was that the equity holders basically walked away in the end. They didn't pursue their motion for creation of an equity committee. They withdrew it. Some of them did, in fact, file the required information, but many of them didn't. And at the end of the day, they ended up cutting a deal with the debtor whereby they walked away, essentially, in exchange for payment of their fees. And the judge wanted and was very clear that he was going to have no part of them come in at the end of the day and disrupt things. The nature of a bankruptcy court being one of equity is highlighted by the fact that there are, in fact, cases that have gone the other way. There's another case that There's another case that comes out of the Southern District of Texas, Pacific Lumber, which had a very, very similar situation, a fight between a group of hedge funds that organized as an ad hoc committee of unsecured note holders, fighting with the debtor. The U.S. EPA was involved. The company was a timber company. And the court in that case held definitively that those holders were not required to disclose their individual holdings and the price that they paid for them. So the end result of what John was talking about is this, is that you need to be very careful. Bankruptcy courts are quick, and judges are quick to see through things. They're quick to understand what a creditor's ultimate agenda is, and they will act accordingly, and they have a great deal of discretion in which to act, which is evidenced by both the Northwest Airlines case and the Pacific Lumber cases, which really addressed identical issues and came out 100% on opposite ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, those hedge fund investors, my experience is the last thing they want to do is tell you anything. The times I've gotten those letters, I don't even know who, they're not even willing to tell you their names, and you get a letter from a law firm who claims that they represent these people, and they're not even willing to let you know who those people are so you can even figure out that they're in fact holders. One thing I want to make sure we do at this point at least is remind people we have about 15 minutes left. We've been trying to answer the questions as we've gone through this. And want to make sure we do answer those questions. One question which I'd like to throw out to Ben is maybe on the claims trading issue, how, if anything, do you think that's affected your guys' strategy or other players in the market and affecting their investment strategy when this claims trading is going on sort of all around you?
Well, there's kind of two sides to that. You know, the first sort of relates to the question that I asked, which is, you know, can you even effectively trade claims? And, you know, the answer for us as an institution is it's really hard to get involved in a what I'll call an illiquid if you're not permitted to trade, an illiquid non-control investment. So if I'm going to even consider a non-control investment, it sure as heck better be liquid. And if I'm not sure whether it's going to be liquid, then that's going to be a problem. And in terms of other people coming in around us, you know, our feeling is that we typically like to invest as a senior secured creditor, so we feel pretty confident that absent some really strange secured creditor cram down, we'll be able to make sure that our interests are being, you know, well considered by the judge.
And Darren, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that issue either.
You know, it's. I think I would agree exactly with what Ben said. I think that's right. I mean, from our perspective, I think there's too many variables in where the judge comes out. So we really tended to stay away from a lot of it the last couple of years. But Ben, I agree with, as an outsider to this process, I agree with you.
John, do we pick up with you on finishing up slides 22 and 23?
Certainly. And just to follow that point that the business guys were making, the claims trading has been an active process for many years, and the code specifically contemplates the trading of claims in bankruptcy. There have been times when debtors or creditors' committees have attempted to limit claims trading in bankruptcy. And I think one part of Ben's question that I failed to answer a few minutes ago was whether claims trading orders have been effective in limiting trading during bankruptcy cases. It has certainly been the case that debtors have been able to limit the ability of equity holders to move their equity around post-petition because they've been able to point to a very specific benefit of the estate that may be lost, and that is the availability of net operating losses on a go-forward basis emerging from bankruptcy. As many of you probably know, if a certain level of equity securities trade hands, the debtor loses any net operating loss carry forward that it may have had going into bankruptcy. So debtors have been able to effectively restrict the ability of equity holders to trade out of their positions post-petition because they've been able to claim that such trading would affect an asset of the estate, which is the tax advantage of the NOL carry forward. And judges have gotten pretty used to entering those types of orders once those orders are entered, the ability to trade equity securities is somewhat limited. But it's not normally the case that the types of investors we're talking about here in this program are interested in equity securities so much as they are in debt securities. The trading of debt securities has nothing to do with any asset of the debtor. It doesn't affect your tax position. It doesn't affect anything. It simply affects your ability to communicate effectively with your creditor groups and to negotiate a solution to your problems. There have been debtors who have tried to restrict debt trading during a bankruptcy case. Some have even been effective at that, presenting various arguments to various bankruptcy judges that if you allow people to trade in and out of their positions during the bankruptcy case, we'll never know who we're supposed to negotiate with, and we'll get 90 yards down the field and find out that we have no agreement whatsoever. Some judges have been receptive to that type of thing, and there have been some debt security trading orders entered. None of them have gone up on appeal, to the best of my knowledge, where I'm sure that such orders would be stricken. Again, there is no benefit to the debtor that's being defeated by the ability of debt holders to trade their holdings. Each of those debt holders certainly has its own property interest in maximizing its recovery, and if its recovery comes from the secondary market rather than through the distribution in the bankruptcy case, so be it. Depriving that holder of its ability to trade out is really raises a constitutional issue. So I wouldn't be so much concerned about claims trading orders or debt trading orders that are entered if they come back, which I hope they don't, in all likelihood on appeal, at least if someone has the time and the energy to appeal them, it's my opinion that they won't be enforceable. Nevertheless, the code does contemplate, and as I said, specifically provides for, what happens to claims purchasers in bankruptcy. You have to note your purchase of the claim by filing a couple of pieces of paper with the court and sending them out to your seller so that everybody knows who's watching the docket, who's buying up the claims. That's certainly the case with respect to general unsecured claims. Obviously, if you're buying claims that are represented by a security, you don't have to make that registration because each holder of the security doesn't have its own claim against the estate. Those claims are generally processed through either the agent or through the indenture trustee. So you can buy claims in a security that are represented by a security without having to go through a registration process. All of those purchases, whether they be of a general unsecured claim or whether they be of a security, as I say, should be generally valid and enforceable. The problem arises, as we note in slide 23, that the holder, the purchaser of the security, even particularly, as Roseanne said, if you come in late in the game, if the purchaser thinks that they can come in and blow up the process, courts will resist that. Judges will resist that. Certainly you're going to get resistance from the other players in the game who have worked so hard to move the case along. And Roseanne's recitation of the events in the Northwest Airlines case is indicative. Many millions of dollars in legal fees were spent over a two-month period in a really unbelievable fight between a number of very sophisticated players represented by very sophisticated lawyers who were all scrambling on the one side to preserve a deal that had been negotiated and on the other side to increase the value of securities that had only recently been purchased. The debtor and the committee, the official committee of unsecured creditors, argued to the judge, and the judge agreed that to allow those types of disruptions in a bankruptcy case is antithetical and really doesn't advance the process any. So it's not even so much a matter of whether they were right or wrong about Rule 2019 and about Rule 506 or Section 506 and about all the various legal arguments that were thrown about by both sides. It's not really a matter of whether they were right or wrong. In fact, one could argue, and a prominent lawyer did argue recently in a long article about Northwest Airlines, that the judge was wrong in the rulings that he made on that topic. It doesn't matter. The point that's being made by the judge in that case and by the practitioners, and a point that I think you'll see made by a lot of other judges in high-profile cases, is that you can't simply come in and blow up a case just because you want to double the price of the stock that you bought at 5 cents to 10 cents. and make everyone else suffer just so you can make a profit on your penny stock purchase at the last minute. And judges will find any way they can, in my opinion, whether it be under Rule 2019 or anything else, they'll find any way they can to make sure that that doesn't happen going forward. That doesn't mean it can't happen. If buyers of claims in bankruptcy or buyers of securities of a bankrupt debtor simply adopt a more sophisticated attitude toward the process and realize that they need to buy early if they're going to buy, they need to treat the other players in the process with a certain degree of respect, and they need to lower their expectations as to how much they can accomplish and what time frame they can accomplish it in, and come to the table just the same way that every holder of a claim comes to the table in a spirit of cooperation and negotiation aimed toward a reorganization in a large Chapter 11 case. All of those objectives can be met. They'll take a little longer, and they'll be a little bit more expensive to achieve. But you can ultimately be successful in your attempt to make money on distressed securities if it's approached properly.
Well, we've really reached the end of the program. I wanted to thank all of our panelists, particularly Ben and Darren, for taking the time out of their day for working on this, and also to Roseanne and John for putting this, the vast majority of this material together, and their thoughts. If anything, after this, I've learned the lesson that I really need to lean on my bankruptcy, my finance, and reorg partners who really know the ins and outs of this process. Again, thanks to the panelists. Thanks to Wes. For those participants who didn't get to get their questions answered, I'm sure we'd be happy to answer any or all questions that you have. Our email addresses are listed in the back of the presentation. We will be rebroadcasting this program at DwayneMorris.com in about a week or so. So, again, thanks to everybody. I appreciate the great interaction and insights from these market participants as to what's going on now, but probably just as important, what's going to happen in the future. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for selecting West Legal Ed Center. For optimal savings, why not consider a customized subscription? You'll get unlimited access to the largest, most current CLE library offered online. Call 1-866-765-MCLE for more information on how to maximize this opportunity. That's 1-866-765-MCLE for continuing education that's always comprehensive, always relevant, always current.